Allahu Akbar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa salatu wa salamu ala ashraf al-mursaleen Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in Rabbi shrahli sadri wa yassirli amri wa ahlul uqdatan min lisani yafqahu qawli Assalamu alaikum. It's an honor to be here with all of you. But I actually want to make a kind of mental shift and talk about a couple of serious implications of what's happening in the world today. A few months ago in Brooklyn, where I teach, a man was stabbed in the stomach in front of his wife and five-year-old child and was told, I'm going to stab you because you're Arabic and because you deserve it. According to CNN, 2015, there were 63 incidents of attacks on mosques, and this is the highest number ever, stating that 2015 has been one of the most inherently anti-Muslim periods in American history. Attacks on mosques have often been used to see the measure of Islamophobia, but this is very limited, because beyond just the desecration of mosques, anytime you open Facebook today, you see stories of Muslim women being attacked wearing their hijab. You see stories of men in their turbans or jalabiyas. Even sick men have been attacked because they seem to be Muslim. Essentially, Muslim women being attacked more often using their symbol of hijab, where today the physical symbols of Islam, mosques, hijab, turbans, these are the ones that are being under attack, and the people who enter these institutions or who wear these garments are being dehumanized. Fear of Islam has become more and more prominent in everyday political discourse. From the nationwide anti-Islam rallies of last fall, the controversy surrounding several mosque zonings, the illegal surveillance of MSA and college students, the attempt to pass anti-Sharia legislation in over two dozen states, the arrest of a boy with a clock, the vitriol coming out of the current Republican primary, questioning whether a Muslim can be trusted, whether Muslims in office can be trusted. It seems that anti-Muslim sentiment is on the rise, and according to Gallup, 48% of Muslim Americans say they have experienced racial or religious discrimination. And unfortunately, last year we saw the end result of this with the burning down of a school in Houston, the execution of three young Muslims in North Carolina, and when two people in Michigan were asked if they were Muslim, and when they responded in the affirmative, they were stabbed repeatedly, and not to mention the two most violent acts that occurred in the Bronx a couple of weeks ago. Political campaigns include statements that the United States is a Judeo-Christian country, indicating that Islam has no place here, that a Muslim president can't be trusted, that Muslims essentially should not be included in cabinet positions, and that mosques should be closed. We had several people running for office in the Republican ticket, and today, the one who seems to be winning the Republican ticket in its totality says that Muslim Americans should be excluded from the definition of what it means to be an American. During President Obama's 2015 State of the Union address, where he states that the United States is a nation that would not tolerate anti-Semitism, the entire congressional body stood up, rightfully so, and applauded in support. And in his next breath, when the president states that America will stand against the rising anti-Muslim sentiment, and the entire chamber of Congress remains silent, we all heard this loud and clear, that for the first time it seems that our elected officials are starting to agree. This is Islamophobia. Islamophobia is defined as the irrational fear and hostility towards Islam and Muslims, perpetuating negative stereotypes, resulting in bias and discrimination, and ultimately the end goal is the marginalization of Muslim Americans from civic and political life. There's actually an objective here, and the objective is that we buy the story that we don't belong. We buy the story that there's a problem with us. Irrationality leads to the propagation of certain myths about Muslims that are fundamentally unfounded. And these are the myths that concern us the most because they're not true. So for example, there's a certain pretty popular Fox talk show pundit who keeps repeating the statistic that 40% of Muslims worldwide support terrorism. So what does this mean, 40% of Muslims worldwide? If there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, well, then the population of Tunisia, 11 million, Morocco, 33 million, Libya, 6 million, Jordan, 6 million, Indonesia, 250 million, Muslims in India, 172 million, 182 million Muslims in Pakistan, 30 million in Malaysia, that every single one of those people in every single one of those countries would have to support terrorism for that statistic to be true, when we know that these are all countries that have had democratically elected presidents, these are all countries that the democratic aspirations of those populations have been met, and those statistics fundamentally do not reflect truth and reality. But that is something that we tend to hear almost every night, and that is one of the myths that we are working against. It's this falsehood that leads to the scaring of people about Islam and Muslims, making people distrustful and fearful of their fellow Americans. And this is further perpetuated by those negative stereotypes that want to marginalize from civic and public life. And essentially, it's fundamentally antithetical to what it means to be an American. Where are Muslims? Muslims are everywhere. On the East Coast, 20,000 physicians are Muslim. They are driving your taxis, feeding you on the street, heading your banks and your hospitals, fixing your teeth and your roads. Muslim Americans both erected the original World Trade Center, Muslim Americans died on 9/11, and Muslim Americans helped erect one steel beam, the first steel beam of the Freedom Tower today. Muslim Americans have been part of the very fabric of this country. In a 2000 book called Muslim Veterans of American Wars, it lists the names of hundreds of American Muslims, men and women who fought in every war going back to the American Revolutionary War. Yes, Muslims served in the Revolutionary War and in the War of 1812 and the Civil War and World War I and World War II and in Korea and in Vietnam and in the Gulf War and the current War on Terror, as Americans for America. Muslim slaves, Muslim scholars, 20% of whom were women, were among the slaves brought to America to build this country, to preserve their identity. They did this in a way that preserved their identity that was under attack and was deemed illegal. And the acceptance and embrace of Muslims as active members of society was the norm at the time. After all, it was President Grover Cleveland that appointed Alexander Russell Webb as the ambassador to the Philippines. Alexander Russell Webb, a Muslim in the 1800s, who started the first mosque on Broadway in New York City, where he invited his friends, Oscar Wilde and Louisa May Alcott, and even President Cleveland himself, to attend the masjid. And when Benjamin Franklin established a non-denominational religious meeting house in Philadelphia, he emphasized not just the non-sectarian nature of it, but stated, even if the Mufti of Constantinople were to send a missionary to preach Mohammedanism, which is what they used to call Islam, he would find a pulpit here for him. Why is all of this relevant to us today, especially in the vitriol of this election campaign? Remember when President Obama was candidate Obama, and the media was talking about there's a candidate running for president and his father is a Muslim, and it led to a debate about whether a Muslim can be president. It wasn't the first time this debate was had. On July 30th of 1788, William Lancaster, a delegate in the North Carolina Convention to ratify the US Constitution, is warning. But let us remember that we are forming a government for millions not yet in existence. I have not the art of divination. In the course of 400 or 500 years, I don't know how it will work. It is most certain that a papist might occupy that chair, that a Mohammedan might take it, and I see nothing against it. The chair he's referring to and warning about is the presidency of the United States. Can a Muslim be president? And in this debate is a question of whether there should be a religious litmus test that only a Protestant could be president. and what we see emerging in the heated debate over the identity and future of this country is a debate between the Federalists and Anti-Federalists over whether a Muslim can be president. And what is the conclusion of this debate? Is that there would be no religious litmus test. And it forces them to say that in the future, in this country that we don't know how it's going to work, a Muslim could one day be president. The ideals that this country was founded on are what Americans really hold dearly. After all, Thomas Jefferson, the philosopher, envisioned a country that was going to be a safe space for all religions, a religious neutral ground for Christians and Jews and Muslims and Hindus and atheists. It was not meant to be exclusionary, but according to Gallup today, 86% of Americans see Muslims in a negative light. And this is worse than 1 week after 9/11. 86% of Americans see Muslims in a negative light. Islamophobia has led to the return of an exclusionary identity where Muslims are the threat, where they represent difference and change. And the inclusion of Muslims would mean a redefinition of what it means to be American. And so this can't happen. And this irrationality is the heart of Islamophobia that we're struggling with today. And it's toxic. And as strong as it is, it's inherently against American values. But what are the effects of all of this on our identity? When our identity is constantly defined for us, when Muslims are told, you are not us, when we are constantly reacting, when reacting to narratives and theoretical frames that have been decided for us, when reacting to pre-established frames that are limited, because they're irrational, when we're confined to defining ourselves not by what we are, but by what we're not. And then we're stuck constructing our identity as a reaction, when we know that this is not what it is. And we can't accept those frames, and we can't accept Islamophobia, and we don't just challenge those frames, but we establish new ones. And this takes us to Ashab al-Kahf, the youth that left the worldly gain for the promise of the Akhirah. A group of youth who, some scholars say, actually didn't really know each other well, but what united them was a firm conviction in their faith and a dedication to seeking the pleasure of Allah. It is Surat al-Kahf that we are encouraged to read every single week, that every Friday, and we're even told that by memorizing and reading the opening passages, we will gain protection, that Muslims in the early years of Islam face these very same trials and difficulties, and that trials, even though they would change over time and evolve to the situation of Muslims, it's as if Allah revealed this chapter in the early part of prophethood so that Muslims would be aware of the challenges they would face, and the challenges they would face would transcend time and space. Are any of us under the misconception that the world is not a struggle, that the dunya is not a test, that we would not be tested? Are we better than those before us? In Ayah 14 of Surah Al-Kahf, and we made their hearts firm and strong when they stood up and said, O Lord of the lords of the heavens and the earth, we shall never call upon any god other than you. If we did, we should indeed have uttered an enormity in disbelief. In the 16th year of Hijrah, under Sayyidina Umar ibn al-Khattab radiallahu anhu, when he leaves on a journey to Syria, and with him is Abu Ubaidah radiallahu anhu, they come upon a creek. And Umar radiallahu anhu dismounts from the camel, and he takes off his sandals, and he puts them behind his shoulder, and he leads the camel over the creek, and Abu Ubaidah tells him, O commander of the faithful, are you doing this? Are you really doing this? You're taking off your sandals, putting it on your back, you're leading a camel through the creek yourself. I don't think it's going to be easy for me to tell the people of this country to honor you. Look at you. And Umar says to him, if only someone else had said this. O Abu Ubaidah, I have made this a deterrent for the nation of Muhammad alayhi salam. Verily, we were a disgraceful people, and Allah honored us with Islam. قَدْ أَعَزَّنَ اللَّهُ بِالْإِسْلَامِ. And so if we seek honor from anyone or anything other than Islam, then Allah will humiliate us. أَعَزَّنَ اللَّهُ بِالْإِسْلَامِ. As Muslims, we should have a sense of honor, a sense of izzah, a sense of karama that we are Muslims. And this is an obligatory pride. Alhamdulillah alladhi hadana li hadha wama kunna an nahtadiya lawla an hadana Allah. We thank Allah who has guided us, because if it were not for Allah, we would not have been guided. We are humbled, but we are proud. And this pride is predicated on understanding that it's the value of our faith imbibed in the principles established for us, that being productive American citizens that stand for justice is not just our civic duty, but what makes us special is that it's also our religious obligation. And so we, as Muslim Americans, become unapologetically Muslim. We have a sense of izzah because we know the numbers. Muslim Americans, especially Muslim American women, are one of the most highly educated religious minority groups. Muslim Americans. You know, as someone who teaches foreign policy, most of my audience is usually men, right? So I'm honored to have all these ladies in my audience. Muslim Americans are the most economically stable religious minority group. What does that mean? In 2008, when the economic crisis hit the United States deeply and actually had international ramifications, it didn't hit the Muslim American community as hard. Why? Because our faith tells us we cannot enter into unjust economic practices. And there are parts of this country that the Muslim community that are in a majority, like in Middlesex County in New Jersey, actually saved that part of the economy because they didn't enter into these economic practices. Muslim Americans are the most economically stable religious minority group. Muslim American women earn as much as Muslim American men. We have one of the most leveled economic gender parity. My colleague at the University of Seattle conducted a study that finds the more mosque-going you are, the more civic-minded you become. The more you attend the masjid, the more you know what's happening in your locality, the more you actually engage. The more mosque-going you are, the more civic-minded you become. And one of my professors at Princeton University released a study that finds that the more you understand the Quran, the more pro-justice you are. Justice for all. Negative perceptions of Islam today are worse than they were 1 week post 9/11. The birth of the Islamophobia industry, $50 million a year to tarnish the image of Islam as anti-West and anti-woman and anti-Semitic and anti-justice and angry and anti-everything, is a business. But what does it mean for us today? It is not bleak. Youth, and really the message is to you. You are the great equalizers. It is no longer 2009. You are rewriting the story. You are writing your story. You're emailing and texting and WhatsApping and posting and tweeting and retweeting and checking in and G-chatting and blogging and vlogging and hijab tutorialing. You are uploading and downloading and updating Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat. You speak a language that I don't speak, but you speak a language that knows no bounds. If the printing press changed the world of access to information, you are speaking a language that's changing the interconnectedness of people across time and space. And essentially, you're giving a voice, not just to yourselves, you're giving a voice to the voiceless, a voice to those that suffer globally and locally, and you are the great equalizers. You are countering the narrative. You are the ones who are holding steadfast to American ideals that say, I am a Muslim, I belong, I am protected by the Constitution, I'm a part of the fabric of this country, I fought to make America what it is, and America needs me today more than ever because I have izzah. لَقَدْ أَعَزَّنَ اللَّهُ بِالْإِسْلَامِ. You are the generation of Muslim Americans that will stand against injustice because you know your lives don't matter until Black lives matter. You know that it won't matter until we get into the inner city and work towards social justice, that baked, that breaks the bounds of privilege and says we can't fight for the rights of others until we fight for the rights of all, access to equal education, access to affordable housing, ending mass incarceration of blacks and Latinos in this country at the hands of the for-profit prison industrial complex that hits every single one of my students in Brooklyn, that standing against drone strikes and the sale of cluster bombs today, and of tear gas that aims to control the democratic aspirations of people that live in our homelands. That we, as Muslim Americans, stand against structural injustice for all, that this is our story, and our story is tied to the stories of others, that if we're gonna fight Islamophobia, we fight against all of it. We can't break this until we understand that we have to awaken to all the structures of injustice. It's you, it's your generation. It's the millennials that everybody says is selfish and self-absorbed and taking selfies. It's you that's raising the bar. It's you that's holding steadfast to the story of Ashab al-Kahf and saying, I am a Muslim, I have izzah, I am redefining the narrative, you're rewriting your story, and by extension, you're writing all of our story. Don't ever let anyone tell you otherwise. You know the code that the ummah is like one body. If part of it hurts, then all of us are hurting. And when we think of the part that hurts, we think of Palestine and Darfur and Rwanda and Egypt and Kashmir and Sri Lanka and Syria and Syria and Syria. May Allah shower his mercy on the people of Syria. We think that that's the part that hurts. But what if it's us? What if those of us that stand in the privileged country, that have access to power, what if we're the weak ones? What if the whole world is waiting for us to stand up and say enough is enough, enough injustice? What if it's us? What if it's you? This is our moment. The entire world is waiting for Muslim Americans to wake up and say enough is enough. We're reclaiming our identity. I have a sense of honor, I have a sense of izzah, I am a Muslim, and you will not define me. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum.